You are listening to the Smooth Sounds of Punk News Podcast, episode 326. This is John Gentile, features editor at Punk News. This is the Punk News Podcast, where we're doing late nights here at the Punk News Podcast Hovercraft office. We're keeping it smooth, sensual, easy breezy cover girl here at Punk News. And I'm here with the easiest breeziest cover girl, managing editor Adam White. Managing editor Adam White, are you feeling smooth and sensual on this late evening, this late recording session?
I've had like two glasses of red wine, and I'm working on my third, so this is potentially as smooth as I'm going to get before I fall asleep.
I'm having a beer myself right now.
What?
Aren't you a root beer?
Oh, there we go. Never mind. John suddenly got interesting for 4 seconds, and then threw it.
That underlies Adam White's philosophy in life. One is more interesting when drinking. Speaking of a guy that's always interesting, we are here with news editor, reviews writer, interviewer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, what's happening? How are your technical difficulties treating you today?
Overall, I think I've overcome all of them for now. So we'll see if I drop out or not during the podcast. But even I'm smooth sailing a little bit. I had a scotch before we started. So this is, I think I'm at about Adam's level.
Well, there you have it.
Good for you, Ricky. This is the substance abuse that I'm trying to encourage with this show for the children that listen and everything. Before we started, just the problems that we're alluding to here is that Ricky has one of those computers that uses a flywheel and pneumatic tubes to operate. And then what happened? too many moths got into the aperture and died there. And then you had to clean out the crust and. It took a while.
The hamster stopped running on the wheel and all that stuff. Yeah.
So we got three winos here on the Punk News Podcast telling you their thoughts, and there's nothing more interesting than a drunk guy telling you what he thinks about the world affairs. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from HE, and here's what HE has to say. John, I've been a fan of podcasts for some time now. During the last episode, number 324, Here Comes Our Shitty Future, I wanted to thank you for explicating on the very dark days ahead. Adam White was obviously tired, as many of us were, but was too deferential to the transfer of power that has begun between the Obama administration and Trump. Tom Trauma's response to the election results were, on the other hand, more disappointing to me. After pointing out his bland neighborly attitude, he descended into the absurd protection his guns would provide for those at greatest risk of violence under the Trump administration. Tom must be aware that he or someone he knows well is more likely to be killed by one of those guns in an accident than using them to defend anyone who is in danger. Realistically, he'll hardly get the chance to fire a single shot, should it come down to it, not with the National Guard and military forces under Trump's control. I believe the entire episode should have been devoted to the election, given its significance. The fatigue that drove Adam White to argue against that is one of my fears as we begin to combat the human rights disaster ahead. We cannot stop. There is no rest. If someone isn't up to it, hand it off to someone who is. Inaction all too often communicates apathy. That's part of what got the U.S. into this horrific mess to begin with. Your voice had all the seriousness and energy I've heard since before in your work. Keep at it, John. Don't let it go for one moment. Find those you trust to step in when you can't move a muscle due to exhaustion, but just don't stop. And let me end with this. Years ago, I sat with a very old woman I knew who had barely escaped Nazi Germany. On one of my visits, she brought out a photograph that showed herself and her fellow students when they were all young. She then told me she was the only one to make it through the Holocaust alive. I think that among your podcast co-hosts, you are the one that can best understand what the movement meant and why the present situation is so dangerous. Fight then, as we all must. And of course, keep up your much-appreciated work at Punk News to give the struggle needed, meaning Punk Rock Communicates. Keep up your work at Punk News to give the struggle the needed, meaning punk news music communicates. I can think of no better music to do so. Just don't stop, man. And that's from H.E. Well, H.E., thank you for writing in. I appreciate the compliment. And I will not stop. This is from Dan. Dan says, hey, guys, love the podcast. Long-time listener, first-time writer from England. I want to call John out for saying living life as an accountant would justify a boring death at the start of 225. We're not all boring. Most of us are boring, but not all of us. Anyway, I haven't got much to say. I always check out your recommendations. I'm loving Dead to Me and Red City Radio right now from Dan.
I'd like to chime in with regards to the first record and say that I'm still pretty sleepy.
I don't remember saying accountants should die boring deaths, but I assume I did.
You generally find large, odd, not usually persecuted swaths of people, and then you persecute them. It's sort of your thing.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I mean, you know, a little persecution here and there never did anybody any harm. You know.
Yeah, that's what we're learning, right?
This is from a different Dan. Dan's got a long email, but I think we'll read it all because that's what we do. His email is titled "The Secret History of MXPX Losing Their Religion" from Dan. And I haven't read this letter yet, so if anything really wacky comes out, don't blame me. This is the first time I've read this, but maybe it'll be cool. We'll find out. This is from Dan. Hello, Punk News Podcast peoples. Sorry, this is a long one. After hearing Adam's viewpoint on MXPX, I wanted to write in and relay my own thoughts on their supposed religious beliefs, which I've never heard anyone else have exactly the same thoughts on. I think their stamp as a Christian punk band is the most misunderstood and at the same time irrelevant aspect of their history. I discovered MXPX just after being an early 90s grunge kid. In 1996, my mom, afraid of my heathen rock, took me to a Christian bookstore saying that I could get any CD I wanted. The employee said that if I liked Green Day, then I would like a band called Mix Picks. The CD I got that day was MXPX's second album, Teenage Politics. And 2 weeks later, when Life in General was released, I got that too. My mom's ultimate intentions were thwarted, however, because MXPX was my gateway into the existence of 90s skate punk and the like, which took me away from grunge but was still pretty heathen by my mom's standards. Having followed MXPX closely for 20 years, I've had my suspicions about their religious beliefs, but this was little more than fan theory. Then in 2015, Mike Herrera was interviewed by Ben Weasel on the Weasel Radio podcast, and Ben flat out asked if MXPX was a Christian band. I recommend hearing Mike's response yourself, but Mike Herrera admitted with some trepidation that it wasn't something he believed in anymore. This helped confirm what I had supposed for years, that at some point all or some of the members of MXPX had a change in religious conviction, but kept it to themselves, out of their music, and away from fans or any mainstream Christian press that would be interested. If you listen to their first two records, it's undeniable that they were Christian, with some songs even directly referencing Bible verses. But Life in General only has a single reference to God, and nothing on any record is clearly, undeniably a reference to Christian doctrine. That makes me think they may have stopped believing in as early as 1998, with their album Slowly Going the Way of the Buffalo. It's my personal opinion that MXPX kept this change of belief out of the lyrics and interviews because at first, it's not anyone's business if they want to keep it out themselves, and second, they were in a lose-lose situation since becoming Christian punk band in the first place already alienated some would-be fans, so why would they alienate anyone further? Just keep your mouth shut and do what you wanted to do in the first place, play your music. In the Weasel Radio interview, Herrera talks about how they just wanted to play like any band would, but coming up as a Christian band put pressure on them from the Christian music industry people who questioned why they didn't evangelize and why they wouldn't pray in the middle of their sets. And I know they were getting the same pressure from the other side with people assuming that their music was a joke because they hitched themselves to the Christian music industry. MXPX music, however, is too good, and I think they broke away from the shitty, divisive albatross of the Christian music industry as best they could. I will also fight anyone who claims that MXPX, as musicians and as artists, are anything but genuine, doing what they do because they love writing and playing fast, fun punk rock for their fans. I'm sure when you're a teenager and have a strong positive experience with your religion, it's natural to use it in your artistic expression. But after national exposure when Christian fans accuse you of not being religious enough, and non-religious fans accuse you of being too religious, why tire yourself out trying to fight on all sides? Just keep playing your music, believe what you want to, and quietly drop that aspect from your public persona. I should also say that I think it's presumptuous to assume even based on the Ben Weasel interview, what exactly you think Mike Herrera or the other members of MXPX do or do not believe at this point. It's sort of cliche to assume he's quietly atheist or agnostic. He very well could believe in some sort of Christian thought, but not in a way that is accepted by the mainstream Christian right. Born-again Christians often believe that Catholics are going to hell. Take the wrong deviation of the Christian right, and suddenly you have to fight for what you believe in against people who supposedly share your belief. MXPX, as I said, was my gateway to the wider world of punk, and if they handled that any other way, kids in the same position could have missed out on something special. I just wanted to share, since I've heard a lot of talk about them over the years, but I've never had this exact view. And by the way, John, your implication that they might be giants was akin to the Rembrandts made me nauseous. I can't defend They Might Be Giants post-severe tire damage as punk rock, but I've always seen their first 15 years as natural pop punk perfection, as the natural pop perfection of the NYC art punk scene. I'm really glad you started with the Then Collection, though it's the best place to begin. Don't even think of listening to any greatest hits comps until you've gone through the first five albums. That's my advice. Thanks, Danny. Danny, I will follow your They Might Be Giants advice. I'm working through the catalog chronologically. Adam White, I think you had something to say about MXPX, didn't you, previously?
Yeah, I mean, that was a cool insight on it. I've never had that. I was never so interested in them musically that I felt the need to really try to square the religious circle or figure out what was going on there. If for no other reason than the hint of that had turned me off, as I had explained in that last episode. The one thing that the letter writer said, that Dan said, that is totally blowing my mind right now, is he said that the Christian music industry people weren't happy with them because they weren't praying in the middle of their sets. Is that what, like, legitimately religious bands do?
It is, and I know this for two reasons. In my high school, in the Battle of the Bands, my friend Dave Cornelius, his brother was really religious, and in the middle of the Battle of the Bands, he started praying, and it did not go over well. But I kind of felt sorry for him, because I was thinking, well, he's just doing his thing. He's not really, like, you know, but, like, that didn't go over well. And then, my friend in middle school and high school, who was never really my close friend, Greg Gordon, took me to the Newsboys. Have you ever heard of the Newsboys?
So yeah, I went to a Catholic grade school and high school, and at one point when we were all in our ska punk phase as teenagers and listening to like Real Big Fish and things like that, my friend's father or his, no his father my friend's like more religious grandmother or something came home one day and was like, oh, I hear you're into the rock and roll music now, here's a Newsboys CD. I have the best callery to this, and I'll come back to it in a sec, but go on your Newsboys thing.
Well, I'm sure your story's better. So he took me to Newsboys, rather his mom did. It was like me and like four guys, and I think his mom was like trying to convert us, even though she actually had no idea of our religious background, which thinking back 15 years now, like, I'm surprised my parents were so cool with that. It's like I guess they thought I was smart enough or strong-willed enough to not be swayed, but maybe I should be exposed to some things that I might not be exposed to. But also, it's like, it's kind of like messed up taking other people's kids to like a religious thing, you know what I mean? I don't even think I knew it was religious at the time. But anyway, so they took us, she took us, and it was like really bad. It was kind of like almost like Backstreet Boys, but crossed with U2. It was really bad. And in the middle of the show, they did a big prayer for like 15 minutes. And I'm pretty sure like Christian rock bands, pretty much all of them, will do a prayer in the middle of the set.
You see, that seems strange to me for no other reason than I tend to, the part of me that wants to be like I guess open and accepting to people's religion usually comes with the expectation that I'm not being evangelized to. Like, if you want to believe a thing, right? But don't push it on me. And that's usually where my line is. So that's kind of like how I like to imagine that the world works. Where in that, if I went to see a band and that band was made up of, you know, a bunch of Roman Catholics, they're not going to turn around and try to convert me in the middle of the thing. That just happens to be what they are, even if it informs their lyrics. So the fact that you're going to stop and do something overtly religious as part of your act is super curious to me. It's as if, John, to me, it feels like, so let's say you and I formed formed a band of North Americans of Italian descent.
Yeah.
Right. We're not going to stop three songs in and make some sauce.
I would.
Like, Like, we're gonna bring a crate of Roma tomatoes on stage or something and start working on the sauce in the middle of the thing. That would be odd. You just, like, you know, the Italianness there, it may inform what you do, but you're not.
True.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, no, but that same friend who had the Newsboys CD, one of my best friends, best man at my wedding, in fact, we at the time were listening to, you know, Less Than Jake and Real Big Fish and Sublime and everything else that people listened to back in, like, 1998, right? But at one point, him and his dad are driving around. His dad's driving him somewhere in the family van, and he's got a cassette tape with Real Big Fish's Turn the Radio Off album. I don't know what, their debut from, like, 1997, 98, something like that, in the car. What was the year?
I was just gonna say it was 20 years ago, because they're doing a 20-year anniversary for that.
Okay, so probably maybe 96. Okay, so anyways, he's in the car with his dad. His dad's driving. They have a tape with Turn the Radio Off on it. There's a song on Turn the Radio Off called Nothing. I don't know how much you two happen to be familiar with the Real Big Fish universe, but the song Nothing ends with the refrain of, I don't fucking care, I don't fucking care, I don't fucking care anymore, repeated over and over and over again, getting faster. And you could tell, as this started, whatever level of tolerance that my friend's father had for the stupid music that he was listening to slowly started to fade as the I don't fucking care anymore is repeated over and over and over. And finally, he just rolls down the window and he goes, that's enough of this, pops the tape out of the cassette player, throws it out the window onto the street. And that, when we were teenagers, just became, like, became the answer to anything. And any media that anyone doesn't like was just like, oh, now you're Schmid's dad, and you're just like, that's enough of this, and poof, out the window it goes. So,
Adam,
there you
Adam, while you're a dad, let's say one of your kids is about 14, and one of your kids' friend's parents takes your kid to a concert, and it turns out it's, like, a religious concert. Would you be mad, or would you be like, whatever?
I would probably be unhappy with that. I don't know if I could justifiably be unhappy with that, but I think I would be unhappy with that.
Would you be personally insulted because, in a way, they're saying, I don't think your values are good values, so I'm going to put my values onto your kid? Would you take that personally?
Yeah, because one of the things we've learned having kids, and I think this is the same for anyone that's a parent right now, is that most other parents are cool, but there's a small number of other parents that are really hung up on whatever particular philosophy of life that they've chosen to embrace parenting with. In my circles, it's never religious, but it's always, you know, you'll have these parents that have particular hang-ups about, I don't know, germs or food allergies or discipline or whatever else, right? And they're just, they have no chill, for lack of a better way to put it, right?
Where are they, helicopter parents?
Yeah, right. You'll get that, right? Helicopter parents are parents that will say, like, severely overschedule kids, and then guilt trip everyone about it. So, like, our daughter right now, who's four, she doesn't do anything extracurricular because she's four, and, you know, she's barely on a good day able to not, you know, pee her pants. Like, it's not. She doesn't need to go to, like, 15 classes outside of going to kindergarten, in our opinion. But, and, you know, when we had her in youth soccer over the summer, which was a disaster because 3-year-olds don't like to do things coordinatedly. In general, we just don't have her do stuff, and she's fine with that because she just wants to, you know, draw and break things, which is what 3 and 4 year olds do, in my opinion.
And most punk rockers.
Yeah, right. But we'll have parents that have, you know, kids the same age, and those kids are in, like, four different kinds of dance classes and then other stuff. And it, I mean, A, I don't, that from a selfish standpoint, that sounds really tiring. I don't want to do that. But more so than that, they don't just, like, put their kids in these things. They put their kids in these things, and then they sort of, like, project out that the way that they're undertaking this parenting thing is perhaps slightly more virtuous than whatever way the rest of us are doing it, right? And that pisses everyone off in our universe here. So I could totally see that type of objection coming up to it with regards to, oh yeah, I took your kid to some religious thing for sure. The part of me that says like, maybe I shouldn't get too up on my high horse about it is that my opinion with, as far as the kids and religion and everything has always just been that, you know, well, yeah, I've made my choices in life about what I'm going to believe and not believe. But, you know, in the same stripe of me not wanting, you know, religion forced on me, I'm not going to force whatever particular beliefs I have on the kids. So if at some point they legitimately decide that they're going to become like a snake handler or something, then, you know, I guess I'll support them doing that. I just don't want them to do that at the behest of, you know, the influence of someone else's parent. That's weird.
What if the parent takes your daughter to a Nickelback concert? What would you do then?
It's Canada, man. We go to Nickelback concerts every 3 weeks.
As always, you can reach that podcast at punknews.org. Adam White, play a Nickelback song, play a Newsboys song, play something in that cherished vein.
All right, so this is going to be the exact opposite of that, I guess. So this is, as with most weird things that I find, a little crazy lo-fi band out of Ottawa. It's called Nightshades. They released an EP in 2015 called Wendy. So this song is called London Bass, or I guess London Bass. It could be about fish, but it's probably London Bass. And it's nice, crunchy, lo-fi, female-fronted punk rock. It is just super distorted and dirty in the way that I like to find things these days. So anyways, this is Nightshades from London, or from Ottawa, with the song London Bass.
And that was Nightshades doing London Bass from their EP Wendy, or London Bass. Listen, speaking of surprising things, fish from London, but also here's another surprising thing. A Day to Remember won their lawsuit against Victory Records. This is a battle that has been going on for six years. What happened 6 years ago, A Day to Remember won it out of their contract from Victory Records. And Victory Records says, no, you can't go. So A Day to Remember had to figure out, how can we get out of this contract? They had a 5-album deal. And they went to their lawyers, and the lawyer said, well, according to our math, you've released 13 albums, because their label was counting reissues, live records, DVDs, all that stuff. Meanwhile, Victory Records was saying, you can't get out of the contract because you've only put out 3 albums. So they sued each other, and it went for 6 years. Lot of grumbling from one party. The other party kind of just said, we want to do our own thing, if you dig what I'm saying. Well, I'll just say it. Victory Records was going on about how they're going to smash these guys up and everything. It went to a jury it went to a Florida jury with their wacky 8 people panel in Florida. Only Florida. The jury ruled in favor of A Day to Remember. They awarded them $4 million. They awarded them $4 million in damages for back due royalties. They also said that A Day to Remember owns the song compositions, and that they've completed their 5-album contract with Victory. The jury did say that Victory owned the sound recordings, but that's pretty much it. $4 million. I don't know how big Victory is, but I'm thinking that's a pretty big whammy. For most companies, that's a pretty big whammy. Not for, like, you know, Bank of America, but I think for Victory Records, that's probably a sizable whammy. The battle is not over, but I guess, Ricky, I'll throw this to you first. Yeah. Do you have any perspective on this battle? And what's your perspective?
I mean, I don't follow this band, but I consistently hear bad things about Victory Records, just from all parts of the punk scene from people I've talked to. I'm glad that the band got this. $4 million over 6 years, though. I mean, how much are these guys really going to get after legal fees?
What do you mean, how much would they get after legal fees?
Well, I mean, like they got $4 million. How much of that is going to go towards legal fees? Or do they get Victory Records to pay the legal fees, too, on top of the $4
million? Well, it depends. It depends. If in America, legal fees are not awarded to the winning side unless there's a statute that says in this type of case it is awarded to the winning side, or if the contract says it's going to the winning side. However, this could be contingency. It could be hourly. Who knows? My guess is this would be – actually, I can almost guarantee this would be contingency, because I don't think this band has money to spend for 6 years over on a lawsuit. So they'll probably get about $2.2 million, $2.4 million, but then taxes, so they'll get about $1.6
million. Wait, you can get you get taxed on a lawsuit? I didn't know that.
You do, and honestly, you probably shouldn't, but you do.
Yeah.
I mean, because when you think about it, it's damages. It's not a profit. It's money that you've already been owed to begin with, you know?
So. Right, and you've probably paid on them anyway.
Yeah. I mean, like if you get hurt in a car accident, should you pay taxes on that? Probably not, but you often do, you know?
So. Yeah. All right, well, yeah, so good for these guys.
There you go, Adam White.
I mean, that's it.
I mean, we should probably preface this whole thing by saying, does anyone on this show know what A Day to Remember sounds like?
I think I've heard them in passing. I think, aren't they one of the more recent Warped Tour bands?
I read the description, Adam White, and that's all I needed to hear. The description was metalcore crossed with pop punk.
All I'm trying to get across here is that we don't know anything about this band, so I don't want to make any of too much of an artistic judgment kind of statement one way or the other, because it is both not our thing, but also not a thing that we know anything about. Victory is such a weird egg of a phenomenon, and it has been like the whole time that I've been involved in punk news. And just the label, even from the early days, you know, had that tough guy vibe to it. And I mean, a lot of that comes from the types of bands, especially back in like the late 90s, early 2000s, that,
well, no, like the late 80s, like bands like Integrity, who originally signed to Victory Records.
Even you go back to that, and I was thinking like when I kind of became aware to them, right? So like there was when I first started being aware of Victory and being involved with them from a press relationship and everything like that, it was really clear that there was a huge active moneyed and storied scene that surrounds that label that we never really fully encompass when we're discussing them. So even back in like the early days of punk news, we were just like talking about like what was going on in like Epitaph and Fat and Lookout and Nitro and those kinds of labels. Like Victory still kind of fell outside of our out of our world. And I still feel like they have a little, like a little fortified island of bands and fans and, you know, devotees and everything else that, despite all the crazy drama that I think we hear about on our end, either it doesn't affect that, or that, I don't know, or that's just kind of like part of the crazy Victory Records game, and you just make your peace with it. So what I'm really approaching here is where you're saying that, you know, $4 million is a big hit, and like, of course, $4 million is a big hit for anyone, but Victory to me has always felt like a bigger and more self-sustaining thing than I ever give it credit for. I think they're within their world. They're pretty massive. They're pretty big. I don't think they talk to us all that much in recent years, or the bands that we've chosen to cover on Punk News aren't really the kind that overlap with them. So they've faded from our sort of day-to-day coverage compared to how it was at a certain point. But I'm poking around at their website right now, and I'm like, I got to imagine this is still a pretty active thing. So
didn't we followed, wasn't Streetlight Manifesto on there?
Yeah. The reason we followed that is because they are also getting sued by Victory Records.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Streetlight is really the everyone's first example when they want to talk about bands that have been involved in Victory Records contract disputes. And I don't know if that's just because they overlap more with the kind of stuff that we post about, but that band is always brought up, and the Victory's lawsuit history always comes down to splitting hairs on what we actually mean by, you know, signed to a record deal. And A Day to Remember verdict completely mirrors what we've heard from various Streetlight things in the past. So the Day to Remember one really boils down to, what do you mean by an album on a contract? Victory is probably looking at it very much so from the standpoint of, you know, being a music fan, in that, you know what, from a music fan standpoint, they probably did have three albums on Victory. But from a business standpoint, you're going to look at it and say, okay, yeah, we get that there's proper albums, but if you have reissues and you have greatest hits collections and everything else like that, from a business standpoint, you know, that's product you're putting out the door, so that's an album. And if the, you know, the language of the contract, which of course we haven't seen, I guess doesn't make that completely clear to both parties, then that's where the split happens. I mean, a lot of the times you used to hear stories, and this is all rumor on my part, but you'd hear all types of stories about people that were in a band that was signed to Victory. That band broke up or the person left, but then they're back on Victory for their next musical project. And it came down to one of those fuzzy hair splittings about whether, you know, was your band signed to Victory, or were the members of your band signed to Victory and are therefore still signed to Victory, even if they're not a member of the band anymore? Like, you never hear this kind of stuff from other labels, but I mean, someday someone's going to write like a textbook on all the little weird catchems that you get in record contracts, and that, you know, Victory could be the source material for everything in that book, because they don't hear about it from anywhere else. Do you hear about people in those types of contracts, or those types of disputes, at least with, I don't know, with your Epitaphs or your, you know, your Rise Records or your whatever else of the world, the Side One Dummies? You never hear about it. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It might happen, but it never gets out into the public in the same way that it does with Victory. I don't know why that is.
Well, could it also be because, I mean, like Epitaph, Bat, and I think Rise does like a couple record deal, like a couple contracts with, you know, several records.
No, Fat only ever does one record at a time. No, I'm pretty sure.
No, I was talking about Rise.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like Fat's made a point a lot, and they've been very public about it, of, you know, right, signing bands with contracts that, you know,
one
Mike has like scribbled up on the back of a napkin, and then people have signed to, And it's almost like part of Fat's shtick right now. But I got to imagine if you go and sign to Epitaph, you know, you get a fucking contract, and that contract is, I would imagine, a pretty standard traditional recording contract with, you know, with recoupables and album commitments and this, that, and the other. I guess the big unknown here is why Epitaph's contracted acts don't end up kind of like dragging that dirty laundry into the public in the same way that so many Victory acts do.
I'll tell you why, Adam.
Is it something is it that the Victory just has far more comprehensive and artist unfriendly contracts, or is it that there's something about the culture there that is making that happen that doesn't happen elsewhere? What is it, John? Like, what's the difference?
It's the other way. First of all, it's that I think generally Epitaph bands are happy with Epitaph. It seems like Fat bands are very happy with Epitaph. It seems like Side One Dummy bands are generally happy with Side One Dummy. So there's not huge blow up. So if they're unhappy, they ride it out and they go if they part ways. Victory signs these very long deals. Five record contract is a very long record contract in modern history. That. However, my guess, and actually, I should pull the complaint and see what it says, because the contract almost certainly has to be in there unless they sealed it for some reason. Is I think Victory records are very vague, and they're vague so that the Victory records can use it against the artists. However, A Day to Remember Here saw that album itself was poorly defined or not defined at all, and used that to attack. And honestly, there's two other big issues here. The one big issue is, in court, plaintiffs or defendants can be their own worst enemy. There's another lawsuit that I'll allude to, but I'm not going to mention, where the party involved was his own worst enemy to a very high degree. It doesn't really matter. Well, it does matter, but it doesn't. Whether or not you're legally right doesn't always matter a whole bunch. It's whether or not the jury likes you. And Victory Records does not seem to be great at getting people to like them, especially as witnesses. You know what I'm saying? It seems that Victory Records is always talking about how we'll force people to do this, we'll force people to do that. You can't force a jury to do anything. And those types of personalities are often surprised when they go to court and they get the surprise whammy. The other thing is everyone's like, oh, this is great. A Day to Remember is going to get $4 million. This is great. This is great. A Day to Remember most likely will not get $4 million, although I kind of wish they would. What's going to happen next is Victory Records will appeal. And after the appeal, they'll say, well, listen, we're going to appeal, so you're going to have to fight that in court for 2 to 3 to 4 years, because that's how long an appeal takes. So if you want, we can settle it now for $1 million or $700,000 or something like that. And then A Day to Remember will say, no, we're going to fight this to the end, because, you know, we don't really need your money right now, so we're just going to fight it to the end. So then Victory Records might say, and this is all just guessing, but this is common in these scenarios, will say, we'll file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. How do you think of that? And then A Day to Remember will say, well, we'll fight your Chapter 11 bankruptcy because we think your assets are bigger than what you're going to claim they are. And then Victory Records might say, well, even if you're right, you're still going to have to pay a lot of money to fight it that you can't recruit back, so you probably should just settle this with us right now. So that's a possible outcome. I hope A Day to Remember gets a good chunk of that $4 million. But even though they won the $4 million judgment right now, doesn't mean that tomorrow Victory Records is going to write a check for $4 million and mail it to them. Far from that. So
I think we just need to make a quick mention of the urban assault vehicle and then move on.
Please do, Adam. Wait, please do.
It's been mentioned. If you don't know what the Victory Records urban assault vehicle is, Google image search that shit. It is a special, special thing.
Well, speaking of urban assaults, a very famous pop punk band did a urban assault at the AMA Music Awards. At the AMA Music Awards, Billy Joe of Green Day started one of the new Green Day songs. I don't know which one it is, because they all kind of sound the same. But he chanted, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA," which of course is a riff off the very famous MDC song Born to Die, where it's "No war, no KKK, no fascist USA." And quite interestingly, just a couple of weeks ago, Punk News debuted the new MDC song Born to Die 2016, which features the refrain, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." Couple of questions here. First, did Green Day read Punk News and see the MDC refrain and decide to use it? B, it did seem like Green Day wasn't really forthright in saying, oh yeah, we're borrowing this from MDC. Is Dave Dichter entitled to credit, or is this a fair borrowing and Green Day does not have to pay respect to from their source? Adam White, I'll give it to you.
Well, they're in the middle of a show. They're going to do a little call out there as they are jumping between songs. I'm going to give them a pass of not having to like stop and footnote, you know, what they're referencing there. You could, of course, do it afterwards in an interview or something like that. But I don't know if they did that or not. So I don't think they need to stop in their show and be like, whoa, everyone, you know, props to MDC for doing this thing, because it's going to kill the whole momentum that they've got going. So I don't know. I'll give them that. I would love to think that they are regular readers of Punk News. I have got to imagine that, you know, our criticisms of them aside, these guys are all pretty steeped in punk rock. They are, I keep saying I would imagine on this show. If I do that anymore, someone, I don't know.
Well, I would imagine.
Yeah. Fuck, I said it all the time. I've said it like six times.
So what? It's your style. I say it,
like,
it's your thing.
No. Anyways. Green Day will very likely be aware of MDC, especially a song that's famous like that. And from a band that was quite influential to the kind of stuff that they would have grown up on. So I'm going to give it that they know about that. They didn't just pick it up, you know, oh, hey, we need something to, we need a way to protest this whole Trump thing. I don't know. I'm going to be nice to them. I'm going to say, what else are you going to do? I'm fine. Am I supposed to be outraged by this? I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be outraged by this.
I don't know if you're supposed to be outraged, but do you think Green Day reads Punk News?
Oh, we're mean to them. I hope they don't, really.
Hey, they get good reviews generally.
If they're looking for a compliment, I am slowly become more and more fascinated with Billy Joe's hair.
You know, the thing is, I actually did some more reading on what happened, and it turns out they didn't tell the producers that they were going to do this, apparently. So it seemed like it was just kind of like a quick thing, and that wasn't planned out that much. I like to think they're reading. I like to think Billy Joe's listening right now.
Combing his hair. Yeah,
exactly.
Bathrobe.
Choosing what dye. You know, when we've brought them up in the past, since the new record has come out, my one question about them is are they having some sort of identity crisis? And I wonder, does this now make them that band again that is the outspoken mainstream pop punk political band that they were 10 years ago?
That is a really good question, and I am unsure of, and this is going to come back to me, I guess, sounding tired about the whole Trump thing from that earlier letter, but I'm really unsure of what is the best way for a band to, I guess, expend their energy on this. And on the one hand, if Green Day uses it to make a course correction on the direction of their career, that seems more like it would be something done to serve Green Day's commercial interests than it would, you know, actually achieve any meaningful change.
I thought you were going to be nice to Green Day, Adam.
No, they didn't do this. It was speculation on Ricky's part.
No, I'm just asking a question. I mean, this could easily be the direction they go in.
I mean, what might be the thing to do for this band is to not all of a sudden, you know, revisit the Bush years and crank out like American Idiot Part 5 for the sake of Trump, but yeah, you know, continue to be a band with their profile, but throw in all the little, you know, all the sloganeering and everything that they're doing, just like they did in this clip where you know, they had the stage, they realized they could get something into their set, so they worked something into their set. If to me, that's just as effective, if not more, than them going and writing like a 45-minute rock opera about Mike Pence. Like, to me, that would seem perhaps less, I know, less immediate. I like as much of a nothing gesture as this is, it was it feels like it was an of the moment and, you know, spontaneous enough. I mean, it was coordinated because they all knew they were going to do it within the band, but it was a spontaneous enough thing that was in the midst of their performance that feels like the kind of gesture that I would want a Green Day to do. I mean, if they want to actually use their platform to achieve some change, they could by all means be talking to Americans about, you know, all the actual grassroots shit that people are doing that will have an effect, you know, contacting your representatives about this, that, and the other issue, you know, actually using whatever levers there are for you to, you know, make representative democracy more representative for you, all that kind of boring, you know, organizing stuff that, you know, unfortunately isn't really rock music. So I'm on Green Day's side with this. I'm their booster this episode. I'm okay with their little MDC call out, because anything else I could imagine them doing sucks. That's why.
The song wasn't all, I mean, the performance itself, this aside, was not great. So,
well, speaking of punk rockers doing what they can to strike back, Jello Biafra has posted his 50th update of What Would Jello Do, and part 50 and part 51, which you can check out at Punk News, is titled Trump Stole the Election, and it begins with Jello smashing the wall, jumping onto his bed, saying no, 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 in classic Jello style. I love Jello. I think Jello's the greatest. I don't agree with everything he says. I agree with a lot of what he says, but I think whenever he says stuff, it's interesting. Ricky, what did you take from Jello's speech?
You know what? After being a Dead Kennedys fan for so long, I'm gonna be honest. I did not listen to the thing. I could pretty much kind of see where he was going. I did enjoy the first like 30 seconds of him smashing and going, "Why is everyone so stupid?"
Did you watch the whole thing?
Oh, I did. No, I did watch it.
He takes his shirt off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, this, you know, Jello does, you know, he doesn't just, what I like about Jello, whether you agree with him or not, and I'm with you, John. Sometimes I agree with him, sometimes I don't. I think it's okay to disagree with the people you look up to sometimes. What I like about Jello, his histrionics and the way he kind of acts, he makes it more interesting. It's not just like some person on a on like a soapbox, like condescending to everyone. So yeah.
Did you like the part where he actually got up on the soapbox at the end? I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, he's fine. I mean, yeah.
Hold on. I'm gonna pause everything here. We're gonna pause the Jello thing. I just was looking at the comments under the story for MDC's Born to Die 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our commenters 16 days ago posted, "Won't have much of an impact on a 7-inch next year if Trump loses tomorrow." And then 3 days later, the same commenter replied to his own comment and said, "I jinxed it." So, all right, continue.
Ricky, you are right in that Jello's his physicality when he speaks really does add a great, you're absolutely right in that, like, especially for whatever in politics, especially leftist politics, especially in leftist politics, the speakers are usually very boring, and I think it's because getting like worked up is considered undignified, even though the right people do it all the time. But Jello, who is extremely leftist, is very physical in his thing, and it makes it that much more exciting. You're 100% correct.
Well, the difference is that, you know, whether it's like some left-wing politician, they're going to, like, you know, say this, 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 and this. Jello's an artist, so he's going to do whatever he wants to make it interesting. The politician's just going to be like, here it is, guys. And if you believe me, whatever. That's it. I'm going to go take money from my lobbyist.
I'm unsure of my opinion on this. I like seeing Jello mad about stuff that,
yeah,
and you can normally find Jello being mad about stuff in the best of times, right? So yeah. in these times where there's totally horrifying real things that, like, even people that are not Jello are reaching Jello levels of hysteria about, it's surreal to see someone like Jello have to go and react to that, because you know, Jell-O would have been making these kind of statements when Clinton was in office, right? And no one would, everyone was for the most part ignoring him because he was, you know, oh, leftist punk rocker complaining about, you know, neoconservatism and globalization and whatever else. Yeah. Right. Then something like, you know, this mass empowering of white supremacists in the US all of a sudden happens. And you have these guys that have been out there, you know, talking politics in this way for years. And they've all of a sudden got to stand up and be like, you know, like, holy fuck, like this is, you know, there's complaining about the WTO and then there's this, right? And I feel that Jell-O himself is a little bit dumbfounded by, like, what do you even do at this point? Because this is so, I guess, historically unprecedented compared to the stuff that these guys would have traditionally been trying to make issues out of. So yeah, I don't know if I'm completely in line with Jell-O's, like, Trump stole the election conclusion, if only because I don't really know how that's a helpful or fruitful way to achieve anything at this point in the game. But hey, whatever, he's pissed, and it's interesting to watch. It's going to be really interesting to see what people like Jell-O that have sort of made a career out of being a commentator is going to are going to do during this time. I mean, I'm far more interested in what people like Jell-O, or people say like Chris from Propagandy, people that like really have their bona fides with regards to, you know, being a political punk act. I'm curious to what those types of people do to react to the Trump world, more so than I am all this trite talk about like, oh, hey, it's going to be good for punk bands now that there's, you know, Republicans in office. Then that people kept saying that afterwards. And I don't know, that seemed like the most vapid, useless read on the whole thing to me. Like, yeah, that's people are legitimately scared about what this means for their children and their well-being. But hey, great, a bunch of white people are going to be able to make more punk bands out of this. That's nice.
I think people were being flippant and funny, though. I don't think people really like were like, oh boy, it's going to be great punk bands.
I guess, but I heard it so many times over a few days. It was like, all right, like, let's all back this off. It's starting to seem a little bit like we're too far up our own ass, and trying to make some sort of lemonade out of this situation that, I don't know. It got on my nerves after a while, but I don't know. Like, yeah, but take a guy like Jell-O, Jell-O's been out there beating the drum his entire life. And now so much stuff that he's been railing against is in the forefront of the US culturally. And like, I don't know, like, if you're Jell-O, do you feel defeated? Do you feel empowered? Do you want to, you know?
No, he's clearly fired up.
I mean, like, for the sake of a video, but like, does Jell-O turn that camera off and then like cry for 3 days? Because
no. I think he's totally genuine.
Well, it's not that he's genuine. It's that is this the entire ambit of his personality? And I've had the pleasure of interviewing Jell-O multiple times. And from my experience, just from my guesses, Jell-O Biafra in public is not the full sum of Jell-O Biafra, much like many performers. There's a great depth to Jell-O and a great many, I guess, sides of Jell-O Biafra that the public doesn't get to see. And if you read some of my interviews, you can actually kind of see that. I think my most recent one with Punk News, you can kind of see that if you look between the lines.
I mean, he's human, right? Like, he's going to have a emotional reaction to this kind of stuff, you know, outside of the reaction that he has when he's like written a little speech about it and jumps around and punches the walls. Like, there's, you know, it's unprecedented. It's unprecedented. I don't know.
Dude, how awesome is it though that like Jell-O has never stopped being Jell-O? Like, a lot of these punk rockers just come out and like, just, you know, do the old song. Like, Jell-O is always Jell-O, and that he has a certain point, you know, a certain perspective on life that he's never wavered from, and he's never really seemed to lose too much steam doing, you see.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that like someone like Jell-O looks really good in this situation. If if for no other reason than that they've been, you know, in quote unquote good times, they were still trying to get the warning out about this kind of stuff. So that, you know, there's a certain amount of validation there that, you know, these people weren't just being crackpots. Like, you have to be somewhat vigilant on some of these issues. The one thing during his actual talk that I thought was really interesting, and it, to me, is really the salient point there, is he mentions a little bit about how he references back to some of the fights that he's been in against some of the globalization forces. And I'm thinking back to, you know, the WTO protests in Seattle in 99 or 99,
2001. I think it was
99, right? So he talks a little bit about how, you know, the Republicans really latched on to a lot of the sort of blue collar dissatisfaction that those, you know, globalization forces had created in the American public in a way that the Democrats hadn't, and were able to really leverage that as a core of Trump's support and appeal. And I think that to me, out of the whole argument that he makes, is the most thought-provoking point, because those same, you know, those same globalized forces were something that Jell-O and all these leftist punk rockers were out there fighting against in Seattle at that point. And that same, and the dissatisfaction that came from a lot of those same things helped, you know, build a lot of the base that voted for Trump too. And that to me is a super interesting read on things. I feel like it gets a little bit lost at the end where he's jumping up and down screaming that Trump stole the election, because I guess, like, what's the message? Is the message that there's this, that we really need to look at some of these neoconservative globalized forces and things that have happened and see how they affect people on the ground and maybe be a little bit more empathic to them? Or is the message that Trump did something nefarious to steal the election? The latter argument to me is, I guess, feels good to yell and scream, but I guess has less of a, I don't know, there's less of an action step on that one. Like, what do you do then? Like, you storm the Bastille? I don't know what you do.
See, I actually didn't think that the part you're talking about where those, it was the blue collar workers that he's talking about that eventually became the base that voted for Trump. I don't think that was, I mean, you, to me, like, that seems like something I didn't need to hear Jell-O tell me that. Like, if you look at the electoral map and the states he flipped, it's completely obvious that that's what happened.
No, I just mean that the fact that Jell-O was out there at the forefront of fighting against those globalized forces. Like, remember, like, they released that no WTO combo record where it was and
Kim Thal, Jell-O.
Kim Thal and the guy from Nirvana, Chris Novoselic. Right?
That's right.
So, you know, that was totally an issue that he was going on about back when everyone thought everything was mostly fine and that there was just, oh, these, you know, leftist rabble rousers are out there in the streets, but whatever, they're students and intellectuals and hipsters and it doesn't really matter. Right. Well,
yeah.
We're going to probably hear a lot from Jell-O in the next little while, I guess is the message.
Yeah.
So we're gonna keep talking about important presidential issues on this podcast with this very important presidential issue. The presidents of the United States of America have broken up.
No, 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 no. I could take Trump, but I can't take this.
so the long running, I guess, like, grunge era alt rock act, the presidents of the USA, they've broken up. Frontman Chris Ballew stated on Facebook, "You may have noticed that PUSA has been quiet since the summer of 2015, and here is why. We are no longer functioning as a band. Call it what you will, but we have quietly retired from the PUSA business since we are old people now. Never say never is a good motto in these cases. However, we wanted to let you all know officially that we..." So what's up, so you don't have to fret or wonder. So there you go. This band originally formed in 1993. They've taken a few hiatuses and reunions and stuff like that in the past. But I don't know, if you were my age, you heard you know, Peaches and Lump on the radio all the time as a kid. So I honestly didn't know these guys were doing anything, but on the other hand, you know, I bear them no ill will.
Yeah, I didn't know they were doing anything either until about a year and a half ago, where I saw they were coming to town, and I just like looked into them. And this is one of these, it kind of makes sense, because in the 90s, bands were huge. Even if you weren't huge, you were huge. This band actually has a very large, fervent fan base that goes beyond their first album. Like, they have fans that celebrate the whole catalog. And I almost went and saw them a year and a half ago for the sole purpose that they were selling an exclusive live CD that I thought would be cool to have, and then, you know, maybe flip it if it was worth a whole lot of money later on. I did go, and of course, now it's worth a lot of money, and now I want to hear it. And I kind of want to get into this band, but I kind of don't. The point being, this band had a big fan base, and I'm surprised they broke up, I guess. I don't really care. I'm going to play a song. This is
Go ahead, Ricky. Sorry, I just wanted to say one thing. You know, I really wasn't into this band when they were around either, but I did see them.
Were they good?
At FYF Fest in 2014, they played. It was one of those, it was super surprising to me. I had no idea. They were really fun. Mm. I'm not going to lie. I mean, they didn't get like a mosh pit start or anything like that. They were lighter than that, but they were fun. And what was really cool, I mean, and I'm just looking at my review of that right now of FYF. They played Lump, Peaches, Dune Buggy, but they also did some really cool covers. They played, and I think they've always played these, but they played Kick Out the Jams by MC5, and they played Video Killed the Radio Star, and they were fun. They, you know, they weren't, I don't know. I guess it's just sort of, this is probably the way, if you're going to end a band, this is probably the way to go. You know, you just kind of retire without any ill will toward anyone. But you had a good career.
Now I'm kind of sorry I didn't go see me a year and a half ago, man.
They were fun. I mean, it wasn't something like, it's not like something where if I had like, let's say I left the venue, the fest early, and I'm like, and I found out I missed them, I wouldn't have been like, shit, let me back in or anything like that. I was just like, you know what? This is fun. It was just one of those like happy coincidences.
You know what I've found recently is that every once in a while I'll turn on the radio station of my youth to kind of see what's going on, which is 102.1 The Edge out of Toronto. And the thing that is the mainline music on The Edge these days, I have no emotional connection with whatsoever. So it's all this, I don't even know what it is, like I guess it's like the Lumineers and all this stuff that,
yeah,
right, where it's just all... It's all just sort of just toothless, and it's all like, you know, we're big sing-alongs and lots of reverb, and I don't know, whatever this thing is that is like the modern,
it's
the modern
wimpy
rock.
It's right? Wimpy.
It's so there's all this stuff, and so we'll go and I can listen to The Edge for like an hour and a half and be like, I like zero of these songs, and I'm really getting bummed out by listening to this. It's making me feel old. But then every once in a while they'll go, hey, here's something from the past, and they'll play a song like Lump, or I don't know, something by fucking Jane's Addiction or something, or like some band that I did not care about in the 90s, and now I'm like latching on to it like a drowning man and someone's thrown me a life preserver, where I'm like Lump, like this is fucking awesome, like there's guitars and right, it's insane. So yeah, don't get old.
Well, speaking of not getting old, we're going to play a track by Personal and the Pizzas. I talked about them a couple of weeks ago. They got a new album coming out. I'm excited. This is off the new album. The track is called Brain Damage by Personal and the Pizzas.
Yeah.
And we're back, and that was Brain Damage by Press on the Pizzas. We're running a little long tonight, I think. We are running real long, so we'll just blast through some of these. Here's one I do want to talk about briefly, at least. This supergroup has been, I guess, talked about, and people
by you,
by me, for a while now. The No Doubt supergroup and AFI supergroup, which features Tom Dumont, Davey Havoc, Tony Kanaan, and Adrian Young, they've released not a single, not an album name, not when they're coming out with stuff, but they've released their name. Their name is, drumroll please, Dream Car. That's right, Dream Car. Dream Car.
Jesus.
I gotta say, man, pretty bland name. Here's the question.
Do you not get like a starship kind of name from it? Like,
well, look at the font.
Dream Car. I mean, honestly, it looks like a shampoo or something, like a men's shampoo.
No, it looks like a shampoo, but like from, you know, that came back in time from 2100.
Shampoo. Dream Car. The question is, has there ever been a supergroup composed of already like famous people that came together and made a great album, or is it always bloated and uninspired? Prophet of Rage.
Oh, come on. Audioslave was a great supergroup, John.
But I mean, like,
we're just gonna ignore that. Okay, I will contend that I quite liked the Good, the Bad, and the Queen record.
Really? I thought it was a little boring, honestly.
It was a little boring, but I got into it. It was, you know, more dubby than active at times, but you know, I was cool with it. I'm cool with that. So,
are we considering the Falcon a supergroup?
No, because they were not all famous when the Falcon first formed.
Okay. Well, that's kind of my only one that's coming off the top of my head.
The other question is, why do these super groups always have like the shittiest names?
I don't know.
Dream Car, The Good, the Bad, and the Queen. Audio Slave. We're slaves to the audio.
Yeah, I mean, Ricky, to your point, like, you know, we in the punk scene knew who, like, you know, Brendan Kelly and stuff like that were, but
yeah.
But there's famous and there's famous, right? There's
right.
Are you?
I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Does this have a chance of being good?
No.
I mean, this logo is just so fucking pretentious, and that name. I mean, I don't want to like judge a book by its cover, but I don't know where this could go.
Oh man, I was mad. No one.
I'm gonna listen though. I will check this out because I want to know where this goes.
No one appreciated the joke that I put in this article. Not a single person, despite how many comments did this article get.
What, were you just put a bunch of YouTube videos of bands that had "car" in their name?
61 comments, but did you see who the last one is? It's the Cars, Dolly's Car with Peter Murphy, Boxcar Racer, and June Carter Cash. No one appreciated that.
I don't think anyone bothered to even look. They're like, oh, here's the John Gentile thing. Let's jump past that. And
comment on. So anyway, man, I mean, I don't wish these guys ill or anything, but already I'm bored with this band just by their name, Dream Car, you know?
Oh, it sounds like it, just from the look of it, they should be touring with like Angels and Airwaves is the vibe that I'm getting there.
You're right.
So we're going to move on from Dream Car. There's a new video for a new Pup song. So Sleep in the Heat is a song that is on the album that Pup released this year called The Dream is Over. It is a bit of a sequel to the video that the band released for the song Guilt Trip from their debut. In that it also features, I feel bad not knowing his name.
I think his first name's Flynn.
One of the kids from Stranger Things that was in that video is also in this video. So, you could check this video out. It's kind of sad if you're a dog person.
Yeah.
But there we go. It's there. Are you guys aware of what this particular song is about? Like, have you listened to the lyrics of it?
Not like in-depthly, but just related, just so I can get this comment in real quick. I'm surprised they chose this song to do a video for.
Yeah, it's...
I think there were plenty of other more... I mean, for example, let me just bring up the track list here. like my life is over and I couldn't be happier. I feel like that's such a great powerhouse song that they would take advantage of that one other than this, which is, I mean, Sleepin' Heat's a good song. I don't know why they went with this one.
Well, so this is a song that has become, I guess, among people that are into this band, something of a curiosity in that. Yeah. It was described in some of the press the band had done as like the one love song that's on the record, and it is, but it's a love song about the singer's lizard.
Makes sense because they showed pictures of all their pets.
I'm sorry, Adam. What was it about again?
It was about a pet chameleon that he had that died. Sleep in the Heat is very literally like how a chameleon, if you have a pet chameleon, will like sleep on a little rock under a sun lamp.
Okay.
So, and on all of the lyrics in this, all of the forlorn, missing you, you're not responding to me love lyrics are about the interaction between this guy and this lizard. So I find that super fun. There was actually there was a quote in one of them where like one of the band members' girlfriends or something had listened to the record and they're like, there's one fucking love song on here and it's about the goddamn lizard. So anyways, that's what Sleep in the Heat's about. If you listen to it and think about, you know, this is about someone's pet in a little plastic cage.
Do you guys know what extremely famous musician had a song about his pet that everyone thought was about his brother?
Off the top of my head, no.
Michael Jackson's Bend was about his pet rat. And Quincy Jones said to him, why can't you write a song about people like you write about your pet rat? That's true. That's true.
So yeah, there we go. There's a pop video. You should go check it out. It's kind of sad.
Check out the whole album. It's great.
Yeah, also do that. So one last thing that we're going to talk about in this episode before we play one more song, I think. Ricky, I'm going to throw this to you. It's your band. Sure.
So it's been announced that the Bomb Pops have signed to Fat Records, and they'll be releasing their full length titled Fear of Missing Out on February 10th, 2017. The band also released a song called CA in July, the Bomb Pops last released a 7-inch back in 2015 called Can of Worms. You can find the track listing, the album art, and the track on the news article. Adam, I'll throw it to you. Did you give this a listen?
Yeah, this is fun. It's not striking me as something that is, I don't know, as I think dirty and ill-produced as I like from these kind of bands.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just me projecting my own preferences onto it. It's perfectly fine. So I'm cool.
John?
It's no dream car. I mean, I'm sorry, Ricky. I know you're into this band, but I mean, it's hard for me to compare any band to Dream Car. I've got the tattoo already. I've got the shirt, the pants, you know, the collector's glasses, the collector's tee set, the you know, the tee ball. I've got the Dream Car tee ball. You know, the carpet shampooer. I've got the Dream Car carpet shampooer.
So, I mean, just because, I mean, this is a band that I've been sort of, I mean, this band's been around for almost 10 years. This is, believe it or not, this is actually sort of one of those instances where we have a band that was on Red Scare and actually moved to Fat. They did do a couple, one or two EPs to Red Scare a while back. When I heard the news about this, I actually wasn't that surprised because I actually found out about this band when I saw NoFX play 3 or 4 years ago, and both Jen and Polly, the two guitarists of this band, they got on stage to sing the female part of Lori Myers. But what I would do is I would go back for people that don't know this band. I mean, they play a bunch of shows here all the time. I've seen them do DIY shows and then open for big shows for bigger shows. Check out their if you like this stuff, check out the their song, oh god, why am I blanking on it? God damn it. Sorry, hang on a second.
So I put my order in for the deluxe edition of the Dream Car. I got the four LP set, Adam. It's got the acoustic demos.
I found it.
You're gonna feel really bad when that album comes out and it's fucking amazing.
Yeah. So check out the song Out of Hand. I think that's sort of a good place to start with this band. I'd say on the Fat Record scale, they're probably more on the Teenage Bottle Rocket, Mass Intruder, but they don't just do like Ramones core songs they have more riffs. They rock. They put on a really good show. So I would, if you're not sure about this band, give them a chance. I've played one of their songs on here before, a while back, from that 7-inch that they released last year. But yeah, this is cool. I'm stoked for them. There's someone out of they're a band out of where I'm from, sort of. They're from, I think, around San Diego, but they spend a lot of time in LA. So yeah, good for them. And I'm actually really happy for them. This is cool.
Cool. All right. Well, there you go. Check out the Bomb Pops. Yep. Well, why don't you play us out here?
Sure. So I usually play a lot of new stuff or newer stuff, but this time I realize we don't. There's one band that we don't really talk about on here that much, or on Punk News a lot at all. I'll try and throw an article on when they're touring. But the Attics, I mean, they are still going strong. They are. It seems like every few months they're out here on the West Coast. So I'm going to play a song from them, from their album, Fifth Overture, which came out in 1987. And I think they kind of went a more popular route here, but I think this song I have loved for a long time now. And I figure I might as well give the Attic some love on this, on the podcast. So this song is called Don't Let Go, by the Attic's, release, Fifth Overture. Here it is.
Attics. Who knew Ricky was a droog? Look at that.
I dabble in the droogness. I've seen them. I think I've seen them once, but it was great.
Ricky, do you like confetti and streamers and magic? Do you like magic?
Here's the thing. When I saw them, it was like, I think it was like Nightbirds, Leftover Crack were opening that night, and I definitely wanted to see the Attics. I just didn't realize how involved their show was. The most involved show I'd been to up until that point was like Kiss. Like that was the most confetti I'd ever seen Second kiss.
there was confetti everywhere, man. It was everywhere.
Yeah. But no, it was super fun. It just, the show, the only complaint I had of it was the show was way too long. It was like 2.5 hours.
That's my complaint. I drove like 2 hours to see the new Misfits once. It was the new Misfits. It was the Addicts, UK Subs, and one other band. And the friggin' Addicts were the were about to play before the Misfits, played for like 1.5 hours. And the Misfits came out and had like 20 minutes because the friggin' Addicts played for like 9 albums worth.
I'm not kidding. I think the show was done when I saw them. It was like 2:30. And I had an hour drive to get back.
Dream Car never does that. Dream Car comes out. They do a tight 45-minute set.
All right. If you want to email us, podcast@punknews.org is how you do that. If you are Victory Records and you want to sue us, John G at punknews.org is the name of our lawyer. So can I do that? Did I just like mess your practice up?
No, that's fine. And if you're Dream Car and you want legal representation, give us a call. We'll do agents. We'll do licensing. We'll do legal representation. The whole shebang. Dream Car, I want your business.
All right.